From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, new songs and old recordings by Elvis Costello. He talks with us about his new album, which reunites him with his band, The Attractions, and his recent reissue, which features the home recordings that launched his career. Also, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer takes on the subject of sex. We talk with Robert Olin Butler about his new novel, They Whisper. It's about a man thoroughly caught up in his sexual memories and current relationships. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Morning Song, the new CD by tenor and soprano saxophonist John Stubblefield. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Figure skater Tanya Harding says she did not know of the attack on skater Nancy Kerrigan and had nothing to do with it. But Harding says she didn't report some things she learned about the attack to authorities when she got home to Portland after the National Figure Skating Championships. Harding's ex-husband and bodyguard are charged with planning and carrying out the attack on Kerrigan January 6th. Harding says she's sorry and ashamed the attack happened, but she says she's innocent and still wants to compete in the Olympics.
I still want to represent my country in Lillehammer, Norway, next month. Despite my mistakes and my rough edges, I have done nothing to violate the standards and excellence of sportsmanship that are expected in an Olympic athlete.
Harding says she has a lot of respect for Kerrigan and that both of them can show the world two different types of figure skating. The U.S. Figure Skating Association has created a panel to probe the matter. The association will report to the Olympic Committee. Deputy Attorney General Philip Hyman has resigned. The number two Justice Department official says he and Attorney General Janet Reno have different management styles. Hyman made the announcement with Reno today. His surprise resignation came in a letter to President Clinton. Mr. Clinton promised in his State of the Union address to send Congress a welfare reform package by this spring. Today, Senate Republicans have unveiled their own plan. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
The Republicans are trying to seize on the opening that Democrat Daniel Patrick Moynihan gave them when he said that welfare and not health care should be tackled first. The Republican plan shares some of the same points the president outlined, including stiffer work requirements. But Colorado Senator Hank Brown says their plan takes a different approach on how to encourage work.
This bill talks about allowing the welfare recipient to exchange their benefits, if they wish, for a job. They're allowed to take a voucher for their food stamps and their AFDC payment at their option, which they can then trade to an employer for a job.
Brown says he's written to President Clinton offering to work with the White House on a welfare reform bill, but has never heard back. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Israeli and Palestinian negotiators are reporting progress from their new talks in Cairo. Negotiators hope to resolve some problems blocking the Palestinian autonomy agreement. Both sides haven't been able to agree upon who will guard border crossings, or they can't decide on how large the size of the area around Jericho that is to be governed by the Palestinians. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 15 points at 3,922. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is up 4 at 792. This is NPR. Former Iran-Contra figure Oliver North has declared his candidacy for the U.S. Senate from Virginia. The retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel says he wants to take back government from the insiders. North was convicted of 3 felony charges in the Iran-Contra affair, but they were overturned on appeal. Israeli troops have arrested 40 Jewish extremists who tried to set up an unauthorized settlement in the West Bank. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
It was the first time that Israeli soldiers have physically evacuated Jewish settlers since the signing of the Israel-PLO agreement in September. The group calls itself This Is Our Land and is an extremist breakoff from the mainstream settlement movement. It advocates eviction of Palestinians from the territories and has vowed to set up 5 new settlements a week. Last night, about 40 members of the group took over an abandoned Arab house about half a mile from the West Bank settlement of Kiryat Arba. They dedicated the house as the beginning of the new settlement of Givat Lapid, named after a father and son killed by Palestinians nearby last month. The army declared the area a closed military zone, threw journalists out, and arrested the Jewish settlers. The group says they will dedicate another settlement today. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The South African government and the African National Congress are still trying to get dissident black and white groups to participate in upcoming elections. Zulu leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi is indicating he might endorse the election if there can be separate ballots for national and regional elections. The talks this week could determine if election opponents will turn to violence to disrupt the April balloting. Lithuania has applied to join NATO's Partnership for Peace. The Baltic nation is the first former Soviet republic to sign up. Lithuania's president says his country hopes to become a full NATO member. Russia is concerned. Many Russian officials oppose NATO's expansion eastward into former Warsaw Pact nations. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is a very satisfying period for Elvis Costello fans. At the end of 93, a box set reissue was released called 2.5 Years, featuring his first three albums, a live 1978 concert recording, and previously unissued home recordings. Now, on top of that, there's a new album called Brutal Youth that reunites him with his band, The Attractions. Nick Lowe, who produced Costello's first five albums, plays bass on several tracks. When Elvis Costello's first album, My Aim Is True, was released in 1977, it demanded your attention. He had the King's name, Buddy Holly's glasses, punk's pent-up energy, and a songwriter's gift for music and lyrics. He was both returning to the roots of rock and roll and looking into pop's future. A couple of days ago, in spite of a bout with bronchitis, Elvis Costello visited NPR's New York Bureau for a conversation. In a minute, we'll hear one of my favorite songs from the new album, Just About Glad.
It's a funny song because it very nearly didn't make the record.
Why not? I like it a lot.
I do as well. But
I even like the expression, just about glad.
Yeah, and likewise. I had a little difficulty finding, sometimes you make a track and when you play it on its own, it sounds just fine.
Uh-huh.
And then you try to find where you put it on the record, and that's less easy. It seems like every track you put it next to, it seems to make the track before sound slow or it sounds like just wrong in some way. And it took quite a long time until we found just the right place to stick it on the record. We're Just About Glad. I mean, the story is concerned with somebody. I mean, it certainly couldn't have been written by a 22-year-old. It's about somebody who meets an old acquaintance with whom he almost had an affair or some kind of scene, and all the time he's saying, "Oh well, I'm just about glad we never did that. We never did this." And really, you get the feeling as the song goes on that he's secretly really sorry that it never happened, although the girl perhaps is deeply relieved.
Well, I like the song a lot. Why don't we hear it? This is Elvis Costello from his new album, Brutal Youth. The song is Just About Glad.
I'm just about glad that I knew you once, and it was more than just a passing acquaintance. I'm just about glad that it was a memory that doesn't need constant maintenance. There are a few things that I regret, but nothing that I need to forget. For all of the courage that you never had, I'm just about glad.
Elvis Costello from his new album, Brutal Youth. Recently, Ryko Disc released a 4-CD box set of reissues of your early albums with previously unreleased tracks. And it's been very interesting for me to hear that because I hear things about your music that I had heard about before but never could really
understand. For instance, I know that you'd said that you'd played at folk clubs and that you used to perform with just a guitar. I can never imagine that until I heard some of these home recordings with just you and a guitar. So I want to talk to you about some of those recordings. Can we go back to, I guess it was the 70s when you made them?
Yeah, it would have been about 1976 or 75. I don't really remember when I recorded them. They were really just my first demo tape that was recorded on it on anything decent. You know, you always have some kind of tape recorder. Of course, tape recorders then were like big bulky things and not the little convenient devices they are now. And, you know, you start to sound like very ancient when you talk like this, but it's the truth. And it was just recorded in my bedroom, and I sent those songs around. And now when I listen to them, I can understand why, you know, I wasn't immediately signed up. I don't think that's because they're necessarily terrible songs, but I think they're obviously, they don't demand your attention in quite the same way as perhaps the songs on the first album proper do.
Well, let me stop you there, because one of the songs that you record, that you have a home recording of with just you and a guitar, is Mystery Dance, which is on your first recording.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I mean. You can see that I was obviously just on the verge of discovering, style is perhaps not the right word, because a lot of the songs are very different from one another, but more the attitude with which I could put the song over and hold people's attention. I'm very fond, in a slightly embarrassed way, about some of those very, very early songs, the more gentle ones, simply because, like any work by somebody, the very first things they do, you can really hear how you're trying to imitate such and such a singer and mm-hmm. how you're really trying to imitate such and such a songwriter. And, of course, by getting it slightly wrong, you're actually being original. But at the time, you don't realize, you know.
Right.
Whereas with Mystery Dance, obviously, that's a song which in itself is not wholly original musically, because it's a typical rock and roll structure, but it has that edge thing that obviously people responded to in the first album.
Well, you mentioned you know, your attitude, that you were just trying, forming your attitude on these early recordings. I think the attitude on the previously unreleased version of Mystery Dance and the kind of full rock band version of Mystery Dance is different. In the home recording, you sound like you're... Mystery Dance is a song about sexual frustration, about not being able, not knowing how to do it. And in the version with just you and a guitar, you sound kind of ironic and confused. Mm. But in the band version, there's this incredible, like, pent-up frustration in it. And I think the attitudes are different.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, because I haven't really played them back, you know, considered them like that. I was just amazed that the tape had even survived.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it is quite a while ago, and it was actually played on the radio. It was the very first thing of mine that was ever played anywhere on the radio, that tape. And there's a gentleman called Charlie Gillett who had a small record label, and he's written some very good books about music, and he's a passionate guy about music and has always championed all kinds of different musics. And he had a radio program on a local radio station, BBC radio station, but the local London station, which, you know, in the fairly late evening used to play an extraordinary mix of music, which was otherwise just simply not available to you in England. And looking back on it now, there was a lot of stuff that I've, you know, come back to time and time again. Some country things and R&B things, and a lot of mainly American music, I would say. And he occasionally played tapes that were sent in. And in fact, another tape I know he did play was... like a demo version of Dire Straits when they were just sort of starting out.
Well, I want to play your home recording back to back with the version from your first album, My Aim Is True.
And let people be the judge.
Yeah, I like them both. This is Elvis Costello.
Romeo was restless, he was ready to kill. He jumped out the window because he couldn't sit still. Juliet was waiting with the safety net and said, don't bury me because I'm not dead yet. Why don't you tell me about the mystery dance? I wanna know about the mystery dance. Why don't you show me? Cause I tried and I tried and I'm still mystified. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied. Romeo was restless, he was ready to kill. He jumped out the window cause he couldn't see it still. Juliet was waiting with a safety net. Said, don't bury me cause I'm not dead yet. Why don't you tell me about the mystery dance? I wanna know about the mystery dance. Why don't you show me? Cause I tried and I tried and I still missed the fight. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied. Well, I remember.
two versions of Elvis Costello's Mystery Dance from his recent box set recording called 2.5 Years. Now, something else that was previously unreleased that's featured on this box set is Wave a White Flag, a song of yours that sounds to me like it almost has roots in like music hall type songs. This song is so kind of removed from the type of song you usually write, musically anyways.
Well, you know, one of my favorite writers then and still now was Randy Newman.
Mm-hmm.
And I really admired him and still do. And, you know, if you don't play the piano, it's extremely difficult to get that kind of...
almost vaudevillian.
Yeah, it's kind of a ragtime style, you know, and the closest I could get to it was really in a couple of those songs. And I don't want to make too much of them because, I mean, obviously they are very early tunes, so they seem a little halting at times, you know, but that one definitely was, because I mean sometimes Randy Newman around that time was writing songs where, you know, if people heard them at face value, they'd be deeply shocked by what they were saying until you realize he was being ironic, because irony isn't a quality which is you know, it's not everybody's experience, and I would imagine that's what I was trying to do. Although, as I say, it's a little hard to remember now.
Well, let's hear Wave a White Flag, and this is one of the previously unreleased recordings on the Elvis Costello box set 2.5 Years, a home recording.
Take off your shoes, hang up your wings, stack up the chairs, roll up the rug, savor the things that sobriety brings. Draining the last from a jug. But when I hit the bottle, there's no telling what I'll do. There's something deep inside me wants to turn you black and blue. I can't resist you, I can't wait to twist your loving arms till you capitulate.
That's Elvis Costello, a home recording from the 1970s, now released on the box set 2.5 Years. Did you perform a lot as a solo player when you were getting started, just you and your guitar?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I ever appeared in public, it was as a solo, you know, in a folk club. And I did a lot of that, both in London and in Liverpool. And I was also in a couple of bands, you know, but obviously semi-professional ones. And they changed in style from week to week as we kind of mastered things and as we learned things, and because when, you know, you're sort of 17, 18, 19, you're very impressionable of the things. You hear something, you immediately want to play like that, you know, and that becomes the main thing you want to do. And then a little bit later, you sort of get a little confidence that actually there's this one style or a couple of styles that you feel that you have something special to offer to, you know, start following those. So, you know, I had done a lot of those sort of things, and so I'd had both experiences, really, but you know, I hadn't much experience of playing in rock and roll bands until I was in one really properly, you know.
Elvis Costello is my guest. His reissue is called 2.5 Years. His new album, Brutal Youth, will be released in early March. Back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Elvis Costello, he's got a new album called Brutal Youth. How did you get your first guitar?
My first guitar, my mother and father bought me in Spain.
Was that a big thing that they got it in Spain?
I don't know. We were on holiday in Spain. We used to go to Spain every year. I think the first time we went there was about 1959, and that was quite early. People didn't sort of go abroad. I mean, rich people went abroad, obviously, but ordinary people didn't travel abroad that much in those days. And my father is very fond of Spain, and we used to drive there, which, again, was quite unusual. And I had this guitar, which they bought me when I was very young, I think about 9, and I couldn't play it. And it was just a little, like a small Spanish guitar. And when I was about 14, I started, or 13 or 14, I started to pick it up, and I even put steel strings on it, which of course immediately makes it go completely warped, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I saved up my money and bought an acoustic, you know, like a folk singer's guitar, and just worked with that for some time. And then later on, you know, when I was a little older, when I was about 17, I got an electric guitar. That's about it, really. I mean, I with the band I was in when I first came to live in London, our drummer worked for a music store, and he was able to get discounts on guitars. But unfortunately, you just had to accept whichever model came from the factory, you know. And although right. all guitars are made on assembly lines these days, there are some differences between one and another. And in an ideal situation, you would try out the guitar. So my first serious electric guitar that I ever had was a Fender, which came in a cardboard box unopened from the factory. And I took it out, and the action, the relationship of the strings to the fretboard was worse than the cheap Japanese guitar I'd been playing for the previous 5 years. But I didn't actually know you could change it, so I persevered with that guitar. In fact, I played it on half of the first album.
Oh, you're kidding?
And somebody with the other guitar player that John McPhee played on that record looked at my guitar and said, "Why don't you adjust this? Because it must be so hard to play." And I didn't even know you could, because, like I say, I started with the folk guitar, and I never sat down and tried to work out Jimi Hendrix solos or anything like that,
like a lot
of my friends did. And it was just a tool, you know, that you could accompany yourself on. An electric guitar was just like an acoustic guitar, except louder. And then I traded it in halfway through the first album sessions, because they were done in, like, you know, little sessions of 3 or 4 hours whenever I was I could take days off my day job. And I traded it in for a Jazzmaster guitar, which is the one that's been the mainstay kind of guitar that I've used ever since.
I know your father sang in with bands. He was a band singer.
Yeah, with one band, really, most of the time.
And which band was it?
It was the Joe Loss Orchestra.
So he sang, like, pop standards?
Well, I suppose when he started in the 50s, it would have been much more the typical big band ballad. But a lot of those bands kind of folded up in that time, obviously, as the guitar-based music took over more.
Yeah.
You know, that was death for really those big bands, which were obviously modelled on sort of like the Glenn Miller sound or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe Loss and his arrangers were very, very shrewd, and they managed to kind of absorb a lot of the music. And my father is a very versatile singer, and they did the most unlikely covers. You know, they used to cover very contemporary pop records, and, you know, they would do things like See Emily Play by Pink Floyd, you know, with these outlandish arrangements. I mean, I said to Dave Gilmour about that I had this. I know he didn't play on that record, but I told him this. I said, "I bet you any money the original Pink Floyd couldn't play See Emily Play live, because it's a very complex arrangement. It was a studio creation. And here I've got this tape of a radio broadcast from 1968 with my father singing it with this extraordinary band arrangement. It's very bizarre, you know, quite surreal."
Did you share musical taste with him, or did you rebel against his songs?
They both really love jazz and singers such as Ella Fitzgerald and Sinatra and people like that. So I didn't really have any feeling of rebellion against that, because that was the music that was in the house when I was really little. And then it obviously, like most people, you get to a certain age where you assert your own choice about music, and that happened to be right at a great period of English pop music, you know, with the Beatles and mm-hmm. all of that sort of stuff, which they also liked. I can't ever remember them not liking something that was good. I dare say my father had to sing sometimes a song that he didn't care for. And my mother, you know, on the other hand, liked a lot of classical music and took me to concerts when I was little. So I got a little taste for that. So nothing really seemed like off limits, or as if it didn't really belong to me, or I was prejudiced against it.
When you started to sing, did your father think you had what it takes? Or did he not take your voice seriously?
No, he was very encouraging. You know, both my parents were. I've never let them come and see me, but...
You wouldn't let them come and see
not
you?
Not when I first started out, no.
Well, because you were... Why?
Well, I suppose you just wanted to learn how to do it first, and it was kind of embarrassing. But later on, you know, they come to see me play now, and, you know, I can talk about the records with them that I make now.
Would it have been embarrassing early on to have your parents show up at a gig?
Oh, God, I think it would be for anybody, you know, when you're sort of 16 or 17, you know. And my son plays in a band now, and I went to see him play recently, but I had to creep in the back door in disguise.
That's funny, you having to sneak in through the back door. So how famous was your father when he was singing with the band?
Among a certain kind of clientele for that, for dance music, you know, they were pretty well known. I mean, they were one of the better known. Certainly the orchestra was very well known in the country.
Did changing your name have anything to do with wanting to be independent from your father's reputation?
Oh, no, not really. It wasn't like a Frank Sinatra Jr. situation.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, he had had some success. They didn't do that many recordings, so that meant that the fame really revolved around the live performance in dance halls. There were a few recordings, and he did have one hit record in Germany under his own name, as opposed to a performance with the orchestra, you know. Not really. There wasn't any problem about that.
Did he take it personally when you changed his name? Did he want you to?
No. Funnily enough, he had already used the same surname as an alias when doing a cover record. You know, that he had done as a session singer, because he used to do some recording things under other names.
So he used Costello?
Yeah, because it's his grandmother's name.
So is that why you used it?
Yeah. Huh. No, I just plucked it out of the air.
Well, who knows? Who knows? And you used Elvis because of Presley, no doubt.
Well, that was my manager's idea. I think at the time, there were people with very, very obviously fake names, you know, all the punk names.
Right.
And one certainly more enduring, I would say, better way to really, really make people sit up and take notice was to take the name, take a name that, like, in most people's minds, there could only ever be one of. I mean, really, it was a statement of saying, well, here's a singular person, you know. And we didn't exactly debate the significance of it beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Let me just jump ahead to the present before we run out of time. Where are you living now? Are you in Ireland?
We live in Dublin most of the time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you like it there?
It's beautiful.
And are you as well known there as you would be in London?
It's difficult to say.
Does it get in your way?
No. Recently, I don't. It's a small place, and it's very easy to become like really omnipresent, you know. And I don't really want that. I mean, it is a good place to live, where I feel like freer way to live, where I can work without interruption.
Well, I got one last question for you. I know I thank you a lot for coming today. You're a little under the weather and have bronchitis, so we especially appreciate the effort you made to get here. What do you do as a singer do to protect yourself when you have something like that?
Oh, well, this is a sort of extreme, I think, occasion, really. I mean, there's been a lot of illness in England and Ireland, and I think I had the last. It's sometimes these things stay in your system for longer than you hope.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was up in Canada a couple of days ago doing a film thing with the Brodsky Quartet, and we were on a film set which was very, very cold, and I think they're probably just, you know, it was just bad luck, really, you know.
Right.
But normally I'm pretty resilient. I mean, I recently had, you know, I earlier in this illness I had to go to bed for a couple of days, and that's the first time that's happened to me in about 12 years. I'm pretty tough old boot, you know.
Well, take care of yourself, and thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Elvis Costello's new album, Brutal Youth, will be released March 8th. His box set reissued 2.5 years is on Ryko Disc. Elvis Costello will tour the States in the spring. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's more from the album, Brutal Youth. This is 20% Amnesia.
What is your destiny, the police woman said? 20% Amnesia.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, finding the language to write a serious novel about sex. We talk with Robert Olin Butler, the winner of last year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. His new novel, They Whisper, is about a middle-aged married man totally absorbed by his sexual memories and his current sexual predicaments. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by saxophonist John Stubblefield. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A county judge in Michigan has dismissed two of three remaining assisted suicide charges against Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Judge Jessica Cooper is the third judge to declare Michigan's law against assisting a suicide unconstitutional. Kevorkian had been charged in Oakland County with helping two people take their lives in an apartment he leases. Kevorkian has helped 20 people take their lives since 1990. The Senate has passed a resolution asking President Clinton to lift the trade embargo on Vietnam. It was sponsored by two lawmakers who served in Vietnam, Senators John Kerry and John McCain. Senator Kerry says he's pleased.
The vote today keeps faith with the families and with veterans who need answers. And by voting the way we did today, I think we have helped the president to guarantee that over a period of time, we are going to get those answers.
Arizona Senator John McCain spent 6 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. He says lifting the trade embargo will help the chances of getting POW and MIA information from Vietnam.
I believe that on the advice of our military people who are involved in this effort, that the possibilities of a better accounting will be enhanced by lifting the embargo.
The resolution isn't binding on President Clinton, but veterans groups are disappointed. A spokesman for the American Legion says Vietnam hasn't earned America's trust and should not be rewarded. Deputy Attorney General Philip Hyman has resigned, saying he and Attorney General Janet Reno have different management styles. Hyman announced his resignation during the Justice Department's weekly news conference. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Hyman announced his resignation as he sat next to Reno during the Justice Department's weekly news conference. He's the number two official at the Justice Department. In the joint appearance with Attorney General Janet Reno, he said the two did not have the right chemistry. Hyman said he'd sent a letter to President Clinton Thursday morning that states that the Attorney General had concluded that their styles were too different for them to function effectively as a management team. Reno insisted that Hyman, however, had not been fired. At the same news conference, Reno also confirmed that one of her top aides, Lula Rodriguez, had also resigned to pursue other opportunities. She's under Justice Department investigation in connection with a voter fraud case in Miami. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
The government says orders for durable goods soared 8.6% last year. That's the biggest yearly increase in 5 years. The Commerce Department says the jump also included a big December increase of 2.2%. Stock prices closed at a new high today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 18 points to end at 3,926. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. An Egyptian civil court has rejected attempts by Islamic fundamentalists to force a married couple to divorce. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
The judge says he's rejected an attempt to force the separation of Professor Nasser Abu Zaid and his wife, Ibtia Yunus, because the plaintiffs have no direct interest in the case. He's also ordered the plaintiffs to pay all court costs. Seven Islamic fundamentalist attorneys filed the case last June, claiming Abu Zaid was an apostate and was therefore a corrupting influence on his wife. At issue were suggestions in Abu Zaid's writings that Islam's holy book, the Quran, was not a truly divine document since it was transcribed to paper by followers of the Prophet Muhammad hundreds of years after Muhammad died. The defense, however, argued successfully that under Egyptian law, which is based on Islamic law, the only people who can file a separation case are the concerned parties, the husband or the wife. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
Figure skater Tanya Harding held a news conference today in Portland. She says she's sorry that skater Nancy Kerrigan was attacked. Harding says she did not participate in the assault, but she says she didn't report some things that she learned about the attack after it happened. Harding says she knows some people won't forgive her for not speaking up right away, and she says she's let herself and the public down. However, Harding says she wants very much to compete at the Winter Olympics next month in Norway. Oregon Senator Bob Packwood is appealing an order to turn over his diaries to the Senate Ethics Committee. Packwood's lawyer says the appeal will be filed while the diaries are being copied. The court already has them. Byron DeLay-Beckwith's murder trial is opened in Jackson, Mississippi. He's being tried for the third time on a charge that he killed civil rights leader Medgar Evers in 1963. Two previous all-white juries deadlocked on the murder charge. Evers' murder case was reopened in 1990. There have been allegations of jury tampering during the last two trials. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Robert Olin Butler won last year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his book A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. This collection of short stories was written in the voices of Vietnamese emigres living in Louisiana, where Butler lives and teaches creative writing. Butler was an army translator in Saigon during the war. His eighth novel has just been published. It's called They Whisper. The subject is sexual desire. The novel is written from the point of view of a man totally preoccupied with his past sexual relationships and his current sexual predicaments.
They Whisper is a serious literary novel about the nature of physical intimacy between men and women. It's written in the first-person voice of a man moving into middle age, trying to understand this comprehensive and ravishing hold that women have on him. And in fact, he's trying to understand that sort of inner landscape that he carries around inside him all the time, a landscape wherein dwells all of the every woman he's ever loved, from little ways to great ways. And he accesses these people in his meditation, these women, in an interesting way, because as a reflection of and an expression of his intimacy and his love for these women, he feels he has access to their inner voices, and in fact, he lapses into the first-person voices of all of these women. So the book is woven full of the voices of the women that he loves.
Is there something going on in literature that several serious writers at more or less the same time are trying to explore sexuality in serious books, but in very explicit ways? And I'm thinking, you know, you won the Pulitzer Prize, and your next book is about sexuality. Richard Rhodes won the Pulitzer Prize and then went to write a sexual memoir. John Updike's recent memoir, Memories of the Ford Administration, has a lot of sexuality in it. It's territory he's looked at many times in his books.
And Brazil is
Brazil, sure, his latest novel. And then Nicholson Baker has had two novels in a row. Now, these are all very different writers, and you may or may not care for the finished products that they've written, but still you've got a whole bunch of serious writers writing explicitly about sexuality in, you know, perhaps in ways that haven't been written before.
The curious thing is that it's taken us this long to do that.
Uh-huh.
If you ask literate people sitting around talking, let's start naming all the serious literary novels we can think of about war. You'll have
lots
of half an hour, 200 titles.
We'll
or let's talk about let's all the serious literary novels about family relationships. You'll have 700 of them in no time flat. Let's talk about all, let's make, list all the serious literary novels, not just that have sex in them, but actually directly address the nature of sexuality. And you're not going to use more than the fingers on that one proverbial hand. And that's the odd thing to me. Not that there are several of us writing about this now, but you know, where have we been all this time?
Was there a process for you of figuring out the language you would use in your book? And I don't know if you read a lot of pornography at any point in your life, but that's the language that's typically been used in books because there's been not that much serious writing about more explicit sexuality. So in figuring out like what kinds of words you were going to use to describe body parts and what kind of words you were going to use to describe love and how either like romantic or realistic or pornographic it was going to be.
Well, that's the terrible linguistic challenge, which I think has been, in fact, one of the major inhibiting factors about serious writers writing about this. There are no names for these body parts that actually get at the feelings that we who are serious about sex and take it. The kind of sense, the sense of beauty and vulnerability and tenderness and cosmic resonance and the mystery of the personality, actually in a way sacramentalized in the shape and form of this, of these body parts. Those connotations do not exist in the words that we have for those parts.
Yeah, well, most of the words are kind of crude and often insulting.
Either that, or they're clinical and passionless.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing in between. Ira Holloway, my narrator, actually explicitly comes to terms with this linguistic problem in a couple of ways. But here's a passage from the book that deals with that. Speaking of that body part of the woman, which he so deeply loves, and loves for its not as an object, but as a kind of sacramentally charged reflection of the individual personality of the woman, and then by extension a resonance into that yearning for cosmic connection that we all have. So Iris says, if the words for a place so softly, so complexly portaled and swirled, a place so prone to weep and joy, seem ridiculously inadequate to me, then what must they seem to a woman? For a woman to have a place at the center of her that she cannot really see, not like my part, which yields its whole shape to the slightest glance, for her to have such a place like the mystery of personality, difficult even for itself to apprehend, for a woman to have a place in her body that gathers a man into it from his deepest yearning, a place that also cries forth a new child into the world, for to her to have such a place, like the mystery of love and desire and the creation of life, I am sure she has no name for it in her truest voice. Just as there are no names for the feelings in myself that I am trying in all of this to understand. I speak now, speak in the ways that I do, because I am ravished with love for this center of a woman's body that has no name, that can't be turned into a thought, that will not yield in any way but through my senses. And so, because I give words to whispers, to sounds like the faint hiss from the edge of the universe, there are these little bits of broken translation where there are no names.
You know something? I think a lot of women think that a lot of men are real fetishists when it comes to women's bodies. That they've made women's bodies, particularly women's genitals, into these shrines at which they worship, into these great mystical something or another's, that is I think, to some women, to some of us, a little much and a little incomprehensible.
Right. Well, that's what They Whisper tries to make that comprehensible, why that is so. I'm trying to articulate the reality of that seriousness with which men take that part of a woman's body. I think the woman would be uncomfortable and is uncomfortable where the worship makes it feel as if that the object has a reality separate from her own self. I mean, it would seem to me that would be the off-putting thing to a woman. You're worshiping this part of my body in such a way that my own self disappears, and that the body part is surely interchangeable with the similar body part on anyone. That would seem to me to be the deep discomfort that would be evoked by that. Ira Holloway, in my book, and I think many, many men, have a deep sense of the individuality of that part in the woman that they love. That it is quite strikingly personal and unique. And in fact, it is. There are no two alike. and Iris sees sex as a kind of secular sacrament. I've used that word because the churches think of sacraments as objects, physical objects, that have a resonance into the cosmic realities. And so it is with that body part
still sounds a little like fetishism to me.
Well, no, fetishism surely turns turns the object into a thing unto itself, and that's there's a difference between fetishism, which one certainly should turn away from, and a deep and appreciative response to an individual person.
My guest is Robert Olin Butler. His new novel is called They Whisper. His previous novel, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1993. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Robert Olin Butler is my guest. There's a part where your main character says something to the effect of, I sometimes think that my penis is the most important part of me or the truest part of me. I forget exactly which word you use there. It seems like a lot of men do feel that way, in a way that I think most women don't feel about their own genitals. And it's that's very... I think confounding to a lot of us.
I know, but there are passages in the book which try to explain that, because what happens is that in the male part, in the act of sex, the sense of it feeling a terrible boundary in a way that then is suddenly broken. But what is gathering behind that boundary, behind that block, really feels for the man ultimately as a gathering of personality. If you are truly engaged in the act of love, if you are making love to a woman who is there in her vivid uniqueness, it feels like all of your mind and all of your emotions and all of your words and all of your creativity and all of your memory, everything is somehow gathering there, and it's all of that that goes out to the woman in the act of sexual release. And so it's the resistance of the notion of fetishism that the book is trying to do. It's a resistance of the objectifying of these parts.
There's a section in this book where I think you're imagining how a woman would respond to what we're talking about now, to this kind of mysticism of the woman's body, right? To making a woman's body into a mystical thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you to read that passage. This is written in a woman's voice. This is the main character, Ira, thinking that he really knows what a woman he's with at that moment is thinking about him.
Exactly.
Let me have you read that.
Right. So this is the woman who Ira is loving, and he hears her voice and then speaks in her voice these words. I'd met him again, and it had all been business, really. Not that I was blind to his flirting. I am never blind to that sort of thing in men, and it always puzzles me. How desperately insecure they all must be to do this so compulsively. It's not me inspiring the attention. It's something about them that looks inward, something that can't even recognize a specific woman there before them. I watch the flirting seize men when almost any woman comes into their presence. A woman, of course, within a certain range of physical attractiveness. The men do it to anyone. And so not only is it not just me inspiring it, it's never me. That's the effect. It's never any of us. It's just them and their own problem, whatever that is. I don't even exist.
What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, I think that is indeed a woman's sense of the way men often flirt, and there's a validity to it. Many men do that. She's entirely right. Ira, my narrator, let's remember, is speaking these words. He understands that too. He is the antithesis of that. But I tell you, I think that many men who flirt like that compulsively, in a way that sweeps away, seems to, the individuality of the woman who's the object of that flirting, that many of those men are doing that as a kind of of discomfort, fear, at the depth of that yearning that they have to connect to women.
Are you embarrassed with people reading your book now? I think it's just an ingrained reaction that if you talk openly about sexuality, whether it's in the form of fiction or in the form of confession, that the response that one expects you to have is of at least slight embarrassment.
I'm not the least embarrassed by the book. The great Japanese film director Akira Kurosawa said, "To be an artist means never to avert your eyes." And that, you know, that's an impulse that if you don't have it, you can't be an artist anyway. So this is a book where I do not expose the literal details of my life, because this book is all the characters in here are created. There's not a single real life counterpart to any of the characters in this book. But my deepest self is certainly nakedly exposed, though it's not my whole self either. This book is not an attempt at a unified field theory of sexuality. Ira is left in a place that is not where he recognizes that he is not whole. And I hope I'm beyond that place, and I have more books to write about this subject.
Robert Olin Butler's new novel is called They Whisper. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Ann Garrels reports on the confrontation between France and the United States over policy in Bosnia. Tess Viglin reports from Portland, Oregon. Tanya Harding held a news conference today saying she did not know about the attack on her rival, Nancy Kerrigan, before it happened. However, she did know something about it afterwards. Also, Robert Siegel talks with a survivor of the Siege of Leningrad, which ended 50 years ago today. Letters from listeners. And Susan Stamberg talks with Larry Brown about being a firefighter, a novelist, and a playwright.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead likes to call our attention to the work of musicians he thinks are worthy of wider recognition. A new CD called Morning Song is providing the occasion for Kevin to tell us about Arkansas-born saxophonist John Stubblefield and his drummer Victor Lewis. From that new CD, here they are in Miles Davis's So What.
In jazz, being a utility man gets you more work than recognition. Tenor and soprano saxophonist John Stubblefield works a lot, at home in New York especially, playing uptown concert halls and little downtown clubs. Mostly, he's worked for other leaders, from Tito Puente to Anthony Braxton, in settings ranging from the straight ahead to the slightly odd. He improvises solos so clear anyone can follow, and he has a deep feel for the blues. Stubblefield's new album, Morning Song, on the Angel label, seems designed to find him a wider audience, but it's no sellout. Instead, it's a hard-blowing record without any very fancy or tricky material. The album is heavy on the blues and includes a few standards. Stubblefield can play pretty, but his band keeps him from getting complacent. All the players in his group should be better known. Pianist George Cables, bassist Clint Houston, and Victor Lewis, who's easily one of the best and swingingest drummers in jazz now. Lewis carries on a dialogue with the soloist, almost never repeating himself from one bar to the next. Listen to the drummer prod his old friend Stubblefield as he tears off some well-constructed blues choruses. Stubblefield grew up in central Arkansas, about 150 miles from Texas, that wellspring of bluesy saxophonists. In the liner notes to Morning Song, critic Robert Palmer drops the name of another tenor player from Little Rock, Bill Clinton. Palmer doesn't elaborate on the connection, but he's onto something. There is a resemblance between Stubblefield's hard-edged saxophone sound and the president's. At a time when media saturation ensures that every American gets exposed to the same influences, it's good to know that regional accents persist. When you hear Bill Clinton or John Stubblefield play tenor, one thing you hear is the sound of Little Rock.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead writes for Downbeat, CD Review, and Coda. He reviewed Morning Song by saxophonist John Stubblefield on the Angel label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Roger Voblitis, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Bob Balls, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, by popular request, we rebroadcast our recent program on teenagers who have committed crimes and are trying to change their lives. We talk with Mary Previty, director of a detention center in Camden, New Jersey, and two of the young men she's worked with. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.